Before you have a body, thank you so much for being here for our social media and electronics presentation. For Hoff is going to be talking with you guys today. She has been, she came to Trinity last spring and did a similar presentation, and the parents really enjoy hearing all the latest, greatest research out there and all the things that we can do to help our kids thrive in this digital world that they live in. And so I'm going to have Dr. Hoff tell you a little bit about herself, and then we're going to focus on what we can do to keep our kids safe and healthy with and without screens. Okay, Jessica.
All right. Hello. Okay, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm originally from here. I went to Chappelle High School, then went to LSU in Baton Rouge for college. I knew from third grade that I wanted to be a doctor, so was always pre-med, went to LSU in Shreveport for a medical school, at which time I decided to be a pediatrician. And so I came down here for residency and started my residency in pediatrics at Children's Hospital. And while there working in the ER, saw lots of depressed and behavioral disordered kids, and my pediatrics colleagues did not want to deal with them, and I said, I actually like working with them. And so there were very few child and adolescent psychiatrists across the country. I switched residencies and finished an adult psychiatry residency, then a child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship. I finished medical school in 2003, started my private practice in 2008, and I've pretty much been seeing kids as little as four, as old as 25, because you guys remember being 21 and 22 and thinking you're a grown-up, and you're just not. And so I see them really through college and a little bit after into young adulthood, and then kind of transition them on. I see ADHD, behavior disorders, depression, anxiety, bipolar, kind of running the gamut. And I happen to be one of the lucky ones that really like my job. And so I think it's a fabulous job. I'm really happy to help. And it is very clear to me, since I was, I finished medical school in 2003, started residency in 2008, I've really seen the trend happen right in front of my eyes. So we're all reading the news articles about it, and everybody's talking about the trend. I would say I've been talking about the trend for the past 5 to 10 years, and I'm so glad the evidence is coming out to support what I've been saying. I love when I'm about to give talks and something comes out in the news right at the same time. You know, I get those morning emails from the New York Times. I'm not sure if any of y'all read those. But literally my New York Times email yesterday, good morning, we examine the raging debate about smartphones and teenage mental health. I, of course, read the article. Typical American teenagers spend about half of their waking hours on smartphones. So there's a psychologist that's done some of the research. She's a top CDC official. Teen mental health has deteriorated, especially for girls, since about 2008. The suicide rate for girls and boys began rising around then. Feelings of loneliness and sadness began rising too. The amount of time teenagers spend socializing in person has declined, so has sleep. Young people are telling us they're in crisis. One clever study used a variation in the times when Facebook arrived on college campuses and found that anxiety tended to rise after its introduction. Another paid people to quit Facebook and found they felt better. By one count, 55 studies found a correlation between social media use and mental health problems, compared with 11 that found little to none. And so I think there's a little bit of a debate. There is no debate in my mind. All right, it is very clear that since the onset of smartphones, and I read somewhere something like 95% of teenagers at the age of 14 will have a smartphone. I mean, and you guys see it. By the time they're all hitting 7th and 8th grade, you can pretty much see that everybody has one. And so we're watching an increase in smartphones and a decline in mental health. It's pretty clear. And because we understand the development of girls, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, we're going to see why it's really impacting the girls even more because of how they develop their identity and defense mechanisms right around the ages of middle school. All right, so let me flip on my screen. I'm going to give you a few more numbers.
Can we do that for her?
All right. So based on the NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, 2017 study, 3.2 million adolescents, 12 to 17, at least one major depressive episode. This represented 13% of the population. Higher among females, highest among adolescents reporting two or more races. All right, this was a national comorbidity study. Adolescents, 31.9% of adolescents had any anxiety disorder. An estimated 8.3% of those had severe impairment. Higher among females, 38% versus 26%.
I mean, when we're talking 38%, it's just a lot of kids. I mean, we're talking more than one out of four. So when you're looking at a classroom of 20, there's a bunch of kids in that classroom that you know are gonna have anxiety disorder.
2017 study with the Child Mind Institute, 500,000 8th to 12th graders. Depression increased by 33% between 2010 and 2015. Suicide rate in girls increased 65%. It's just staggering numbers. Like, I just want you to see the numbers. I want you to stop and think about it. We're seeing massive increases. All right, and then, like I told you, I like when new data comes out. Literally this morning, CDC data came out from a 2021 study. 3 in 5 girls felt sadness or hopelessness in 2021. That is a 60% increase over time. 3 in 5, 57% of teenage girls said they felt sad and hopeless in the year 2021. That is it's just an astounding trend, and one that I'm seeing in my office every day. And so it's why I love coming to Trinity, because when I can talk to the parents before those kids hit 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 and 17, and we can potentially do something to help this, you have a big role in preventing this. In one of the articles, it talks about how the teenage years really didn't look that different until the last 15 years. If you think about what your teenage years looked like compared to, say, your parents, it just didn't look all that different. Did we have more stuff, more things to do? But if you're looking at, they were just outside playing. Parents were in charge. Kids didn't have a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. We did our homework, we went to school, and we played with our friends outside. Really, that has been the life of kids for as long as we can remember, until the last 15 years. And now you see kids staring at screens. You see them staring at screens in the morning on the way to school. You see them staring at screens on the way home from school. In some of the high schools, you'll see them on screens in the middle of the day. It's just a lot less interaction and a lot more screen time, and it's changing what the teenage experience has been. And, you know, we joke about the, I had to walk 5 miles through the snow to get to school. The truth is, it really wasn't that different. That's why we joked about it. I think, yes, were some things harder in the Depression when people couldn't get food? There's been challenges every year. But the truth is, what teenagers were doing is a lot different now, and it's because of the smartphones. All right, there's tons of articles. I mean, if you're raising kids right now, if you're reading newspapers, if you're reading magazines, you're seeing these articles. Social media use at age 10 could reduce the well-being of adolescent girls. Screen-addicted teens are unhappy. More social connection online tied to increasing feelings of isolation. Multisocial millennials more likely depressed than social media conservative peers. Dopamine smartphones and you about for your time. Does social media make teens unhappy? And so you can just read and read and read article after article, and it all looks pretty clear. It looks pretty clear clinically in my office, and it's looking clearer and clearer as they're doing the research that social media and too much electronic time are hurting our kids. Okay, go ahead. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit about the science. So I think it's helpful to understand, and the reason I think it's helpful to understand, because from a parenting perspective, if you know the science behind it, it's going to make you less mad at your kid. All right, in that article I was talking about from the Times earlier, her two recommendations were, number one, do not blame the teenagers, and number two, the recommendation of screen time is less whatever they're doing is less. And the reason we need to not blame our teenagers is because there's science behind what's going on. And the science is in dopamine. So, you know, we have neurochemicals in our brain that regulate many different things. So dopamine regulates desire, pleasure, ambition, addiction, memory, attention, mood, cognition, and sleep. It plays a role in all of those things. Most people know a little bit about dopamine. Most people have heard about serotonin. And so serotonin is the one I talk about in my office a decent bit too. Serotonin is the one that modulates joy and happiness, different from pleasure and desire, right? And some people have a hard time understanding the difference. Joy and happiness is what we get from laughter, from enjoying time with a friend, from feeling loved. Dopamine is, I just made the goal. I just made it to the next level. I just gambled and won $100,000. That is a flood of dopamine that comes from, it's an exciting pleasure. When you have high levels of dopamine, you are hyper-focused. And so, you ever seen a kid on a screen? That is hyper-focus. And so, focus, cognition. You ever seen a kid get off of a screen? What does it do to their mood? It drops their mood because the dopamine is pounding their mood to feel good. You take that away and there is anger and irritability and there is an immediate frustration that comes. The other reason that happens is that dopamine and serotonin are on a seesaw. And so you can see, and I've seen it in kids that have been screen addicted, they look depressed, but they tell you they're not depressed. And so the reason they'll look depressed is they actually get a flattening of an affect. And so their mood starts to decrease. They get less energy, less motivation, less joy, less happiness. They look depressed. They'll tell you they're not sad, but they look depressed. And I say they're neurochemically depressed because their dopamine's been so high, which has caused their serotonin to decrease. And so there's real neurochemical issues that are happening in these kids that are making them want the screen time more. So I've just gotten hyper-focused, pleasure, attention, excitement. And so, of course, that's what I want. The research on addiction around screens is just becoming clearer and clearer. We were seeing the clinical signs. Man, that looks like addictive behavior. Man, that looks like addictive behavior. Can people really become addicted to smartphones? And the answer is yes. And it's a neurochemical issue. It is not anybody's fault. It's why we need to start limiting young. Just like any addiction, the earlier it starts, the harder it is to get under control. And so this is why we have to prevent our kids from drinking and smoking and doing all that stuff. The marketing agents, and this is a whole nother side of thing, the marketing side in 2018, $1.7 billion to market marijuana. Why do you think marijuana is almost as, or probably is as popular in the teens as alcohol was back in our day? $1.8 billion. My voice doesn't sound very loud compared to $1.8 billion. I talk about it in my office every day. And the reason I talk about it in my office is because I know the earlier you start with addiction potential, the higher the risk of addiction, which is why we want to get these things under control early so we don't have screen addicted kids. All right, this variable ratio reward, it's another kind of chemical playground that psychologists have figured out. And so what we know about variable rewards, it comes from gambling. If anybody's ever done slots before, you know you don't win every time. You lose, 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 win. Lose, win. Lose, 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 win. Right? So it's variable. You never know when you're going to get that hit of dopamine, which keeps you going. And so I don't know. It might come the next time. It might come the next time. So I variably, in variable amounts, I'm going to give you the reward, which is going to keep you coming back for more. Well, guess who did that? Instagram did that. Instagram's like, well, we're going to use psychology against these people. And what they would do is withhold likes. And so people would post their picture. These kids would wait for other people to see it and other people to like it. And what Instagram would do is they withhold likes and they give them in bursts, which would make them keep coming back to check.
I didn't get any likes. I didn't get any likes. I just got 20 likes. Look at all these people that like me. I didn't get any likes. I didn't get any likes. So I only got one. I only got two. I only got three. I got 40. I'm keeping going back for more. So it is this variable reward that is keeping kids addicted to social media. And so I would recommend, if anybody hasn't watched the movie Social Dilemma, I think it's worth watching. It describes some of this, and it's the top people. It's the CEOs that are telling you we're doing it, and they made a ton of money off of it. And so I think it's worth seeing just to help you understand the science of why kids are becoming addicted, why social media is adding to some of that depression and anxiety. They were doing it on purpose because they were making money off of it. All right. You can pass. All right. So that's the end of the slideshow. Now I just keep talking. All right. So why is it causing so many problems, right? So we talked a little bit about the neurochemistry of it. They're getting pounded with dopamine. It's lowering the serotonin. And so that's making them feel a certain way. There's some other pieces to the puzzle. It's the lack of personal connectedness. If you've ever walked into a restaurant, a coffee shop, if you've ever walked in to an eighth grader sitting around with their 10 friends, a lot of them are staring at the phones. And so the truth is we are losing personal connectedness. And anybody who knows, anybody who's grown up or anybody who's worked with older people, like 80s and 90s, you will learn the most important part of life is social relationships. And so it is friendships, it is feeling connected, and it is feeling loved. And we are taking that away. And what we didn't know early on is we thought it was connection, right? We thought that, look, we're connecting with people easier. I'm connecting with people across the country. I'm connecting with my old high school friends. I'm connecting with all of my friends in the class all of the time. Surely this equates to personal connectedness. And the truth is it doesn't. And so it is not doing the same thing, partly because neurochemically, I'm connecting using dopamine instead of serotonin. And so I'm getting a pleasure and a focus without the joy and the love and the emotional connection. We know it all the time as adults. We send a text that has one meaning and somebody reads it a different way. We can't read emotion via a snap, a picture, or a text. And so it requires that personal connectedness. So one of the losses, one of the problems we're seeing is these kids aren't connecting quite enough. All right, interestingly enough, I forgot about this study. There was a study that showed intense social media with intense personal interaction, those kids were not more depressed. And so, you know, there's all these people that are doing these research to tell social media is okay, obviously. It made sense to me that these kids that do have a lot of friends and they spend time at their friend's house and they do have a ton of personal interaction, that personal interaction does prevent some of the depression that's coming from what we're calling social media. So is it the electronic, is it the social media, or is it the lack of personal connection that comes with it? People could argue it's the lack of personal connection. So if you have a kid that's super social, this is why I would say encourage your kids to be in clubs, extracurricular activities, sports, whatever. You find what your kids like and you find what your kids are good at and you make them do it. And I think at middle school, you can still do that. All right, they're gonna have a much louder voice when they get a little bit older. You've got a few more years and where they're gonna keep listening to you. By about 8th, 9th, and 10th grade, they're not listening to a word you're saying. They are watching every move you're making. But your words often go in one ear and out the other. They listen more to their friends at that point. So when you're getting the younger kids, when you're getting the 3rd and 4th and 5th and 6th grade, you still have a lot of control. And this is when you set those rules and you set those boundaries. We have to do a club. We have to do an extracurricular. We have to have play dates. It's Saturday, and I know you want to sit around on your phone all day. You just want to have a break from school, but that's not what we're going to do. We're going to go to the park, and we're going to invite a friend. We're going to join this activity. And not every kid is an athlete. So you go to the makers camps on the weekends. There are robotics clubs. There's, I have an amazing chess player and he just graduated from high school. And so there's tons of things for these kids to do that don't require them to be on a screen. And we need to do that because we now know, at least one study is telling us, personal connectedness is going to help minimize that risk of depression from these phones. All right, another big one that I would say I talk about every single day in my office, and it's about sleep. And so, you know, we were all reading those articles when the phones came out probably 10 years ago about the blue light, and the blue light is keeping us awake. And so then there's the blue light glasses. You know, we're trying to band-aid everything when the truth is we need to put the phones away. And so a colleague of mine did a really good study which was showing kind of neurochemically how our brain is going to reset to get into a quiet place for sleep. It took 2 hours off of electronics before bed in order for your brain to hit restful sleep. I remember him telling, I'll never forget it because I was in an airport. We were going to a conference and he tells me this and I look at him and I'm like, that's never going to work. Like, there's no way I'm convincing these kids to turn off their phones 2 hours. So clinically, what did I do? I've told everybody an hour. I'm telling you the research, right? The research is 2 hours to reset these receptors, but an hour is going to be better than nothing. But these kids that are staring at their phone and they're scrolling, adults, you know, you do it too. I catch myself for sure. But when you're scrolling, we now know you're getting, it's harder to fall asleep because you've got to get your, remember, it's dopamine, it's alertness, it's pleasure, it's focus. So, and it regulates sleep. We've got to get that dopamine down. We've got to get into a restful space. And so we have to turn the phones off a little bit earlier. The other thing that's come out a little bit more recently is that sleep quality actually changes. So it's not just trouble falling asleep, it's actual sleep quality. And so people who are on their phones a lot before bed felt less rested, less restful. And so I don't know, I mean, the article came out years ago, but I would guess it's because it's really still taking too long to get into your stage four deep sleep, because you're still filled with your alertness neurochemical. So again, I talk about this stuff because I want you to know it's real science. There is science behind this, and that's why these kids are having trouble sleeping. And what does lack of sleep do? Lack of sleep causes ADHD symptoms. And so I have kids all the time that will come in. I have the ENTs tell me about it. The ENTs are like, I have kids that are being tested for ADHD. I take out their tonsils and adenoids and they're not ADHD anymore. The truth is lack of sleep causes poor focus, poor attention, difficulty with memory. This is why 20 years ago, I mean, I think it was when I was in residency, they started making those residency rules because that person that was on, there was a surgeon that was on too many shifts in a row, made a mistake in the OR because he was sleep deprived, because his processing speed was lower, because his memory, you know, there's so many things that go wrong physically with us when we don't get enough sleep. And so we know this, and now we know the smartphones are adding to it. So these kids are staying up late. One of the big things, and I'll tell you to start now, and when you start early, it's gonna make your life easier in high school, that the no phones in the bedroom, you either keep them in the bedroom or they have to be on a charger because they're gonna, I'm having a little trouble going to sleep. We've all done it. I'm awake, what am I? And they just pick them up, right? Well, I'll just read a quick article. I'll just do a little something. It's just so easy. The easy button, the piece of chocolate cake is sitting right next to you. It's just too hard to reach. So we've gotta keep the phones out of the bedroom to help them to sleep better. All right, what else are we seeing? We're seeing decreased physical activity. So remember, all of these things combined together. Decreased physical activity actually makes it harder to go to sleep at night. So then we're not sleeping, then we're looking at ADD, and then we're taking a pill. And all of it can come back to smartphones. So we're spending too much time sitting down. And this might have started when the computers came, but computers, better TVs, smartphones, I mean, we've got the iPad, we've got the smartphone, it's just all over and we're not moving when we're watching them. I mean, some of the kids that are like, but I just want my Netflix. All right, can you get on the treadmill and watch your Netflix? Can you do something? Because I need kids to have physical activity. It's something I'll argue with, and I know Trinity's good about it.
there are schools that have taken away recess. I'm like, no, no, no. Schools, this might be the only time kids are getting physical activity. I will high five every PE teacher across this country. Their job is very, very important. Our kids need to be active. And really, young kids, I mean, I'm gonna say it a lot when I give the talk to the littles, but really through fifth, sixth grade, these kids need a lot of physical activity. I mean, and what I want you to do is I want you to be the hard parent in that scenario. Get your kids to be physical activity. When I have one kid that's easy because she's an athlete, and the other one doesn't really love it. She would much rather sit and watch TV. And so when I made her run a lap at least three times a week, I am quite sure she was cursing me the entire time. She would yell at me, she would cry, "You're ridiculous, you're ridiculous." You know what? I had a kid who slept better and had a nicer kid because I forced her to exercise. Exercise increases serotonin. So all of this comes back to science. We know, I talked about laughter increases serotonin, a good night's sleep increases serotonin, exercise increases serotonin. We're all doing things to balance that pounding of dopamine we're getting by half of their waking day on a smartphone, right? So we've got a lot of work to do to balance that, and so physical activity is one of them. Go for walks with your kids. Go for bike rides with your kids. Let it be the family time. We are all overscheduled and super busy. The walk around the park, it'll do it. That is good physical activity, and you get a two for one. You get your quality time with your exercise. I know we're busy, so find the two for ones out there. All right, here's another big one, and I'm gonna talk a ton about it for the younger kids. If you haven't done it yet, I want you to force your kids to learn how to be bored. All right, so one of the things that has happened with the on of smartphones is kids are unable to tolerate boredom, right? They have their easy button of stimulation at all times. And so it was easy. Look, we didn't know how big of a deal this was gonna be. And so, of course, like our kid's crying. You give him, you know, the little video, the cute thing, and he's not crying anymore. Surely that makes him happier, that makes him better. I can go to the restaurant now because I can just put the screen in front of him. I mean, we have all been in the car with kids that you want to jump in the back seat and strangle them, but you can't because you're driving. And so I think the car is hard. And so what have we done? We've pressed the easy button and we've handed him a screen. And unfortunately, when we do that, we are not allowing them to learn a crucial skill of learning boredom. Let's talk about high school. Let's talk about college. Let's talk about a class you take where the professor's up here like this, and this is what you really need to learn. It's hard. It's really hard. It's boring. But I need to focus, and I need to listen, and I need to tolerate that because I need to show up at class every day. You know what? My parents are having a really important meeting in the other room, and I need to sit out in the waiting room, and I need to tolerate boredom. There are so many times in life we have to be bored, and we're not allowing the kids to learn this skill because they constantly have something in front of them. So I'll tell you a couple of my tricks that I use. Number one is no phones in the car. And so if you go with the rule of no phones in the car, they're going to have to learn boredom. And what is my favorite line, and that my kids don't say it anymore, and they know better, they would say, "I'm bored," and I'd say, "Awesome." Yeah. It's exactly what I'm looking for, all right? So when your kids are bored, you tell them great, especially when it's in the car. You need to learn how to be bored. So I want you to use your imagination. I want you to look at the clouds in the sky. I want you to learn things. I want you to make up a dance in your head. I want you to come up with a creative game. The amount of creativity that comes out of boredom, right? I imagine things have been invented from people sitting around being bored. And so we need to allow our kids to be bored. So one of the big ways is not having phones in the car. I learned something new the other day about another reason why we should not let our kids have phones in the car. Our teenagers don't know where they're going. We are teaching our kids to drive at the age of, now I know, 14 years and 9 months, because I have kids that really want to drive. But our 15 and 16 and 17-year-olds who are learning to drive, they have no idea where they're going because they've never looked around. And so these kids are staring at phones. They don't know their city. They don't know their town. If they get lost, they really get lost. And if their cell phone, oh my gosh, died and the battery didn't work or the internet wasn't working and they couldn't use Google Maps, like these kids are falling apart. So we need to teach our kids some really good problem solving skills. We need to have them looking around when you're driving. All of those things are gonna allow them to be better drivers when they get there. So just another perk for you middle school parents with the no phones in the car, it's gonna allow them to see where they're going. All right, how am I doing? It's my time. All right, so okay, so here's the other one that that I'm seeing a lot that in my opinion makes my job a little bit harder is this increase in ADHD. Is it an increase in ADHD or are we just knowing more about it? So, you know, the bulk of our research in child and adolescent psychiatry has been in ADHD in the last 20 years. So the truth is we understand it more, we know more about it, and we have really good treatments, right? So I really love that I can help these kids with ADHD. What we're seeing in our offices now are these kids that we're just not really sure would be ADHD if they didn't have screens. And so are we training their brains to need stimulation early on? Like, these are all of my questions. If you've been trained to need that much stimulation from age two, I mean, I see the two-year-olds walking around with the phones in the mall like this, right? If we are training your brain to need that much stimulation, then regular classroom issues of reading and learning to write and math problems, it's gonna be more boring to them because their brain is craving stimulation because that's all they've known. And so then they're telling me they have trouble focus and they're bored in class and they're forgetting things and they're losing things. ADHD, 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 right? So all of these kids are looking ADHD, and in my opinion, it's making it harder for me to differentiate. There's the family history actually makes it easiest for me, because the parents are like, oh yeah, that was me. If y'all can remember being in elementary school, you knew the kids that had ADHD in your classroom. They were asked to leave. You were like helping them organize their papers that were falling out under the desk, right? So we did all that stuff for them. So I do think, I believe it's a real disorder. I believe it needs treatment. I believe it's genetic. I believe family history makes a big difference. But when you have these kids that have no family history, and their parents were like, I've really never seen focus issues, and they happen to have gotten their phone last year, I'm starting to wonder, right? Is it really that this is when it was supposed to pop up? Or are we having disturbed concentration? So the other thing, there was a study years ago that they did on some college students. And it was, they had students learn information and take a test, and no phones were allowed in the classroom. And then a chunk of the kids next time were allowed to have phones and then took the test. What they discovered was not only the kids who had the phones, but even the kids who didn't have the phones were learning less because of the phones. And it was the disrupted concentration. So when you have somebody sitting next to you and they're scrolling, and you're trying to listen, you're looking. So it's just constantly disrupted concentration. You've seen the kids when they want to take their phones to the room while they're studying. And so why is it taking you 2 hours to study? Because you're focused on this, but that ding or that vibrate or that buzz, or now we don't even have to have the ding or the vibrate or the buzz. We just have the thought of a fear of missing out. So we're so connected to our phones that the fact that I haven't checked it in 30 minutes is making me uncomfortable, and so I'm getting disrupted concentration. And so, am I distracted because I have ADHD, or am I distracted because my brain is a little addicted to my cell phone? I think these are real questions, and these are things I don't have great answers to, but as we minimize cell phones, if we can minimize social media, if we can keep the phones out of the room, if they can learn boredom, and learn to study without the phones, they're gonna be in better shape. And so we need to start having these patterns and behaviors and setting these examples for them early. Okay, so here's the other one that I told you I was gonna come back to. And so it's girls, right? So why do they keep talking about this increase in depression, anxiety, feeling lonely, feeling sad? So what we know, and it's not that it doesn't happen to the boys, but the boys are getting hit with testosterone, right? And so they're feeling aggressive and edgy and moody and like, I want to go punch that guy in the face. That is not what the girls are experiencing during puberty, all right? They're getting hit with estrogen, all right? They're different hormones and they make them feel different. And so what does that estrogen do? That estrogen makes them feel a different kind of moody, and it makes them feel sad, and their bodies are changing, and they feel awkward, and they feel uncomfortable. And what are we adding to that? Staring at what everybody else looks like all the time. And so the social media and the looking at pictures of other people and the looking at what other people's doing, people are doing, they're already feeling self-conscious about their bodies, and that's just normal. I mean, what adult in this room wants to go back to sixth grade? I tell kids all the time, find me a grown-up who would choose middle school, all right? There's not a parent that's choosing middle school to go back to. And it's because we all felt it. We all felt that awkwardness. We all felt that, like, I kind of like boys. I don't know what's happening with my body. Am I going to get my period? I really want my period. They got their period. Are they better than me? I mean, all the stuff that happens. And then what are we adding to it? We're adding constant comparison. We're adding, how many likes did she get? How many likes did I get? We're constantly comparing, and so it is affecting girls because developmentally they're going through this naturally, and we're adding a problem to it, right? So one psychologist was talking about, you know, you wouldn't give an aggressive testosterone-filled kid a gun, but it's basically what we're giving the girls, right? The social media platform is their gun, because it's the way that they can make other people feel bad. They can say mean things because they're feeling bad about themselves, so I'm gonna make you feel little. It's all the stuff that happened. Again, it's another reason we don't wanna go back to middle school. We know the mean girl stuff, the boys fighting, the boys saying you suck at that. We know all of this stuff happens. But then we got to go home to a really safe, private place, and we got to leave it all behind. The cell phones are not letting them leave it all behind. There's the story about the kid that walks in the cafeteria, spills the red sauce, is totally embarrassed because the guy she likes is sitting right there. You know, everybody's making fun of her. 30 years ago, she went home, she cleaned up, she had dinner with her family, she played with her family dog, and she was like, well, that really sucked, and was over it the next day. The kids of today come home, and how many people posted it? How many people posted it on Snapchat and Instagram? How many people posted a YouTube video? And everybody's still laughing and you feel worse and worse and worse. These kids aren't having a safe place to get over the difficult things that are happening because it's always in front of them. This is why social media should not be in middle school, period, end of discussion. All right, the two pieces of information. If you can, as families, get together, and I'm gonna push this hard with the young ones, wait as long as you can to give them a phone. And so I promise you they survive. And so I have an eighth grader and a 10th grader. They had to wait till the end of seventh grade. And so was she the only person without a phone? The answer is yes. And the other moms that were like trying to hold out with me, they gave in during that seventh grade year. All right, I know it's really hard. I know your kids are gonna make really good reasons, and I know they're gonna say the big one, she kept coming after me, but I'm gonna be by myself, I'm gonna need a phone. I mean, I need to call you to pick me up. I said, well, use your friends. Every single one of your friends has a phone. Guess what? You can always problem solve. They don't need, right? So there's a grown-up around. Guess what? There's a grown-up has a phone. Go back into school and call me on the office phone. You don't need a phone. And so what the phones have done inadvertently to us as parents is actually make us much more anxious. Because 30 years ago, you had to learn to tolerate your kid driving off and you had no way of contacting them. And you just really hoped they remembered to call you when they got to the friend's house. And then you had a kid like me who's terrible at it. I would always forget to call my mom. So guess what? She learned to manage anxiety really well. We are not learning to manage anxiety, because we're constantly needing, are they there, are they there? I mean, I swore I wasn't gonna get Life 360, and my kid just got a car. Dog it, I'm checking to make sure she got there every time.
I'm trying not to because I want to manage my own anxiety about it because it's also not fair for us and it's not fair for the kids. We need to be able to trust them. We need to be able to teach them things. And if we can teach them to problem solve, these kids are not problem solving. They're calling us immediately. They're Googling immediately. So we're having a whole generation of kids that can't problem solve. And guess what? When they get to college, they're struggling more. This is why kids are struggling more, because they've never had to figure it out on their own. Let them not have phones as long as you possibly can. And I just strongly, strongly encourage you not to let them have social media. And so social media, we know it, we see it. It is adding to sadness, it is adding to hopelessness, it is adding to self-esteem issues, especially in the girls. It's causing issues. If parents can band together, the more parents talk about it, the more parents are like, well, I'm not doing it. And so then when your kid's like, everybody's doing it, you're like, well, so-and-so's not doing it. I mean, I love it when they say that. Well, so-and-so's not doing it, and so-and-so's not doing it, and I'm not their parent, right? So you're stuck with me. Too bad. You got this, I mean, imagine having me as parent, right? They've been hearing how much cell phone stuff since they were born. But anyway, when you set those boundaries early, when you tell them how you feel about it, when you tell them you're going to set boundaries and you tell them early, then when they're 14 and 16 and you see your kid stressed out and you know it's because she's taking breaks on the cell phone instead of taking brain breaks, which is what she really needs, and you tell her I'm taking your phone during the week and she doesn't have a total meltdown, I high-fived myself that day because she knew. I've been telling her for years, it's making it harder on you. It's making it harder to study. It is empty filling your time, and you have too busy a schedule right now. And so because I've been telling her for 5 years, I think at some level she knew I was right. If that would have been the first time telling her, she might have thrown the phone at me. And I see it. I see the kids totally freak out. I see the kids feel like they cannot manage without their phone. I'm going to have no friends. I'm going to be left out. My life is going to be less fulfilling without it. And the truth is, it's not the case, and we know that. And we might not be able to convince them until we take it away. But when we take it away and they're okay, when we take it away and we see our kids lighter and brighter and more engaged, it's going to remind us that we're doing the right thing. All right, I think I'm hitting the head. Oh, I'm hitting the end. The one thing that I guess I'll remind you guys about, let's see. Focus on balance, phone free before sleep, monitor anxiety, setting limits on your kids, outside time, family time, social time, in-person time. So one big thing that I want you as parents to do is I want you to model the good behavior. And so it is really hard to tell your kid that you're spending too much time on your phone when you're spending too much time on your phone. And so I know we're grown-ups and we can do whatever we want, but it's so much easier when we set those good examples, when we plug the phone in, when our kids don't walk in to tell us goodnight and we're lying in our bed staring at our phone, when we come in from a long day at work and we're having a conversation with them and our phone's in the other room, instead of checking our feed or doing that while we're, if we're not using the phone in the car, if we're not bringing the phone to the dinner table, if we're doing all these things and we're modeling good behavior, it makes it so much easier to parent it too.